that was a huge source of credibility. And I think that was one of the factors that won us our first clients. If you have 1, 2, 3 reference clients, you'll get to 10. If you have 10, you'll get 25. And 25, you get to 100. If you can just execute well.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, I'm joined by Alan Meaney, the founder of Fundrex. We hear why Alan risked his entire future of the business by moving to New York, why a quick no is a huge benefit when negotiating, and why the future of marketing is product-led. Here is my chat with Alan Meaney. This podcast is brought to you by Sage. Sage is the number one provider of payroll, finance, and HR software to small and medium-sized enterprises just like me and you all across the globe. To learn more about Sage, click the link in the description below. Alan, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
You are my first ever guest in our brand new studio.
It's an honor.
It'll be good. We're in the Victorian's building in the iconic offices, so it's a brand new space. So we've got video, we've got audio. How does it feel?
Feels great. Doing stuff in person can be a bit. There's a bit of a magic to it, I think.
We talked about that. We just had breakfast, which is nice in itself, to be able to do that kind of thing. What's it been like for you, that kind of online, offline transition back to the real world?
Yeah, so I think the same as everyone else. It's been tough, but you know, people have really embraced the new way of working. So, you know, we've been remote for nearly 2 years. We've started to get back to the office. People are adjusting to coming in a couple of days. And I think that's the way it's going to be. Like, I don't think we're going to see these extremes where people have been are going to be forced back in 5 days a week. Just don't think it's going to happen. But personally, I've enjoyed it. Like, you know, as an entrepreneur and kind of leader of a business, it's great to get a mix of collaborative work, but then also quiet time where you can do some deep work yourself. So I found that balance good. You know, as a business, we've done quite well through COVID. You know, we've grown strongly. Touch wood, we're luckily in an industry that hasn't been impacted negatively. The opportunities are increasing. More and more people want to digitalize their business, want to automate stuff.
What do you do?
So we try to turn business users into data superheroes. So what that means is our software is used by business users to manage their data workflows, where they're not coders, but they can get the same level of integrations built themselves without having to write any code. So think of it like Zapier, which is a SaaS business that helps consumers connect APIs. In the business world, we help our business users connect files, SFTPs, and some APIs.
What industry is that for?
So mostly in financial services, and probably best known for our work in the funds industry.
Okay. And when you say funding industry, what is that for people that don't know what it is?
Yeah. So when I dropped out of college to start working for HSBC, I thought it was going to be, you know, Wolf of Wall Street type stuff. You know, I'd be in the trading room, you know, we'd be making trades, be very exciting, very sexy. But really, it's doing the back office work, the mundane, managing payments, valuing a fund, looking after the bookkeeping, doing the annual audits. So that's the type of work that predominantly gets done in Ireland. It has rebalanced a little bit towards some front office work with Brexit. So we've seen some asset managers locate trading teams in Dublin. But predominantly, when we think of funds industry in Ireland, which, you know, employs tens of thousands of people and is a big contributor to the economy, it is the back office work that gets done here.
Yeah, it's one of those industries like you hear about all the time, oh, funds, asset management. And you're like, yeah. What is that like? When you say assets, what do you mean? Like, is it stocks, shares, property? What is it?
Funds, so hedge funds, private equity funds that could be either domiciled within Ireland. So they'd be referred to as UCITS funds or non-domiciled funds, which could be based out of Cayman. So the types of investors would be in them, those funds, predominantly institutional investors like endowments, pension funds, etc. And then the work that gets done here is, as I mentioned earlier, valuing the fund is the core activity. So the net asset value or the NAV. So when a fund gets traded, and you might historically have seen the prices listed in Financial Times on the back page of the funds, there's an awful lot of work that goes on in the background to come up with those prices. And that's what a lot of fund administrators do on a daily basis. So if you think about it, like the sexy side of it, the trading, et cetera, is the only piece, and sourcing investors is the only piece that can't be outsourced as an asset manager. They have to do that themselves, but everything else they can outsource to a third party administrator. And that's all the stuff that gets done in Ireland.
How does a fund administrator become an entrepreneur?
Good question. So going back when I was in secondary school, I always wanted to start my own business. I was thinking, well, what as everyone, no one knows what they want to be when they grow up. So what do I put down in my COO? And I was thinking, well, I could do a business course, but then, you know, I'd graduate without any real expertise to start something. So I'll do a...
It's exactly what I did.
So I'll do a computer science course with business. So there's a business information systems course in DIT on Anger Street. So I stumbled through that. Didn't quite get my head fully around software development, repeated second year and dropped out in third year to start working in HSBC, thinking I was going to be working in that sexy job. A friend got me in the door and then spent, you know, 8-9 years working in fund administration, promoted a few times and, you know, still had that itch to start a company and was into technology and startups around 2013, 2014. And had an idea for a collaboration tool that we could use within our business where we would have a to-do list that we could manage our personal tasks, but also share tasks with the team. So I went to that. I went with that idea to one of my co-founders and we basically built a prototype, got it live.
You were sitting there crunching the Excel, yeah. Is that what you were thinking in the back of your mind? You're like, right, okay, I've got a bit of runway here to come up with my own business. Or had you kind of parked that idea and you're like, oh, I think I'll just be... have a career.
Probably an overactive mind is part of the cause. You know, the work can be mundane and, you know, you can grind through it, but, you know, if you have a bit of creativity and a bit of imagination and if you like solving problems in new ways, your mind tends to wander and that's kind of wandered in that direction. Well, how can we better encourage teamwork within the business using software? I think was the idea that I kind of was...
Did you like having a job or did you always think, oh, there's more to this?
I enjoyed having a job. You know, I've always had jobs since being a teenager, you know, plucking turkeys, you know, working.
That's not where I thought you were going to go with that.
Yeah, well, I was thinking back about the other day of the different types of, you know, part-time jobs I've had over the years. One of them was worked for a business that supplied school libraries. So you'd literally have, you know, 500 books that you had to stamp and put the little flyer on the inside of.
Oh, yeah.
And one by one, you would stamp those and put them in the pile beside you. But I guess it just gave me a tolerance for kind of grinding through work a little bit.
Which was worse, that or the plucking turkeys?
The smell of the plucking turkeys.
How did you end up plucking turkeys?
So there's a turkey farm over in Maynooth and I was going to school in Selbridge. And a friend, his father was involved with it and... took a bunch of us in for a week before Christmas to make a few quid. I think it was like 150 per turkey that you plucked.
Per turkey?
Yeah, but okay. You get docked money. If you tear the skin, you get docked money. But by day two, I remember getting the bus over and sure, I'm wearing the same clothes as wearing day one. So the poor people on Dublin bus must be thinking, what is this whole
bunch? How many turkeys could you do in a day?
You could probably, if you're average, you could probably get through 7 or 8, but then...
7 or 8?
Yeah, there was one guy that could probably do one within 5 minutes. Yeah, so it's like it's not easy work and you definitely wouldn't want to be doing it every year, but you know, it was a few quid for spending money.
Definitely a rhyme somewhere there, but I'm not going to attempt it now on air. So from plucking turkeys to fund administration.
Yeah.
When you're in the fund administration, the biggest question and the biggest difficulty I see with people who want to become entrepreneurs but have a job is that the golden handcuffs?
Yeah.
They're in the job. It's pretty okay. It's not terrible. It's not terrible enough to make them leave, but it's not... You know, they've got well paid, probably got a house,
yeah,
maybe a partner. How did you break off those golden handcuffs and go, right, I'm going for it here?
So it wasn't easy at the time. It felt very stressful, felt very pressurized. I did meet someone at one stage who had been involved in social entrepreneurship and was saying, listen, we've been thinking about going full time on this startup. You know, what have other entrepreneurs that you've seen do to transition between, you know, being full-time somewhere and doing their own thing. And he said to me, the only bit of advice I can really give you is everyone that I've spoken to that's gone through that same process has always said, I wish I'd done it earlier. I was like, okay, that's interesting. So when we finally did do it and I finally did go full-time, like got up the next day and the sky's not falling in and everything's pretty much the same as it was the day before, you kind of realize the weight of it lifts off you making that decision. I just turned 30, got married, had a mortgage, a new baby. So it was a little bit of convincing a home that was a risk worth taking. But we were lucky enough to get a place on New Frontiers program, which is a great way of doing that transition because it gives you a salary stipend of $2,500 per month for 6 months. So I could look at it from the point of view as well. I can give this 6 months And then told my wife, if it doesn't work out, I can always go back and get a job in fund administration. Now, I had no intention of going back and get a job in fund administration, but that was the pitch.
Bought you that time. Bought you those six months to make it work.
Did.
And then, sure, it was probably working perfectly in 6 months, right?
We hadn't got a clue what we were doing for 6 months, for sure. We were scraping around trying to get some sort of traction with Task Messenger, which was our first product, which was the collaboration tool. We got a few thousand free users, and I remember like turning up to Web Summit one of the early days, 2013, 2014. And we had a stand, you know, one of the small booths, and Peter Coppinger comes down from Teamwork and says, "Oh, I heard you're the guys that we have to compete with." And I was like, "You don't have to worry about us. You're doing quite well as a business." But it was just funny. Like we, you know, you're going through the startup, I guess the kind of the stuff that goes on around the edges of attending events and pitching and trying to get some traction. You know, I remember one thing sticks out in my mind. We did an event, and Pat Phelan came up and he was coming around to different startups, you know, just asking what you're doing. And the words of encouragement getting from someone that's been through the process and was successful was a huge boost at the time, which probably gives you energy to push through for the next couple of months. So like, I know we talked a little bit about advice earlier, but sometimes even just the words of encouragement that you can get, that, you know, to just saying, keep going, you know, you're doing great, or, you know, it's great that you've got product live, or amazing, you've got your first paying customer. Sometimes those little words of encouragement are the fuel that can keep you going through those early days where you really don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, Pat's one of the OGs, isn't he? He's the real deal.
Yeah.
I want to get him on soon. He's on the hit list.
I'm sure he'd be happy to.
You mentioned advice there.
Yeah.
Advice is tricky as a young entrepreneur. What's the worst bit of advice? Instead, I'm not going to ask you the cliche, what's the best bit of advice? What's the worst bit of advice you've ever been given?
Yeah, I won't give an actual piece of advice, but the worst type of advice that we've been given is, you know, you could have given a 2-minute pitch at a startup event, or a 5-minute pitch about the business, and then someone will jump in with a very specific direction that they think you should go with your idea or your company. Where for me, like, yes, be open to advice and soak it all up, but you have to, you know, view that through your own lens of, you know, you've been thinking about this idea probably for a few years. You've got a few years experience behind you. You know the problem really well. Your gut is telling you the direction you're heading in. You know, probably 9 times out of 10, where we followed our gut in the business when it comes to decisions, we've gone the right way with it. If you try to intellectualize it or overanalyze it, or, you know, oh, well, such and such said it, and, you know, they're a very big name that we should, you know, pivot to this direction, can lead you down the wrong path a lot and can be very distracting. So I guess the worst piece of advice is any of that quick advice that you get from someone that doesn't really understand your business or understand your customers or understand the problem. Like, the best piece of advice is listen to your customers, understand their problem, and find a way to solve it for them. You know, everything outside that can be noise a lot of time.
How do you filter the noise though? How do you avoid, we talked about this earlier during breakfast, how do you avoid putting people on a pedestal? Someone very seasoned comes up to you and goes, "Guys, yeah, great idea. Love what you're doing. But
yeah,
here's what you should do." How do you, what filter or what lens do you put on that?
You sometimes need a good co-founder that you can have counsel with. So like myself and Des bounce stuff off each other the whole time. And we can usually, between the two of us, come up with the right answer. So, you know, if you do get advice and you're thinking, talk to people you trust about it and see what they think, and then take that all on board. But it still comes back to trusting your gut. Like, you know, the thing about a startup is, you know, you're thinking about it subconsciously 24/7. Mm. You know, you're in the shower, you're solving problems in the shower, you go to bed, the stuff you've been thinking about all day, you wake up with the answer. So as you've been sleeping, you've been crunching through the problem as well. So, you know, your gut has probably got all the relevant information that you need to make a decision. And in startups, you know, it's, everything's very fluid. You have incomplete information and you're under pressure to make a decision. So oftentimes a quick decision that you can reassess and change direction later is the best action. So like, don't wait for more information, move with what you have now. Just be flexible enough that if something changes or you learn something new, you can change from there. Because, you know, the momentum and the cadence that you can get for moving forward will determine how successful you're going to be.
It's going to sound very strange. How do you hear your gut? How do you filter it out and kind of go, yep, that's my gut telling me that's not just a wild notion I've just had?
You feel it. Like, you know, you kind of learn to hear it a little bit. You know, we were talking earlier about, you know, the first couple of years of starting a startup, you're very, very green. Like, you literally, the stuff, when you look back now of what you've learned since and the things you were thinking at the time earlier, you think, how naive was I back then? Like, you know, and sometimes you need that naivety because you'd never start the business if you had some of the skepticism that you learn later on. But, you know, yeah, it's trusting yourself a little bit and backing yourself. And then, you know, we were talking, you know, difference between the US and Ireland. Like, in the US, kids graduate with such a self-confidence that they almost, you know, believe everything at an early stage that will allow them to move in the right direction. Whereas in Ireland, I think we come out of college and school with a little less self-confidence, and we have to learn that ourselves as we go through our careers. And it takes us a bit longer to get there. So I think I had the advantage of probably, you know, 8 or 9 years of a career behind me, seeing what a corporate job was like, knowing, you know, yes, they did that well, or, you know, if I'd start my own business, I'd do it very differently. And these are things I'd do. So I had that little bit of experience behind me to be able to, I guess, you know, decide what the best path was. But yeah, it all comes back to trusting yourself. Like, because, you know, when you're a founder, you're pitching the business, you're trying to convince other people. If you can't convince yourself, you know, you just won't be able to get there.
And that, this is something that's overlooked a lot in the whole kind of entrepreneur narrative. You know, it's a sexy entrepreneur narrative. He just came out of the womb and he was a genius. More often than not, it's people like yourself who've had experience in an industry and you've seen the good and the bad, and you come into it with a bank of knowledge to be able to draw upon. How helpful was that for you in the first couple of years?
It was hugely helpful. Like, when we're in B2B, so we're selling to large financial institutions, or selling to the people that are working for them. And oftentimes they're not necessarily rewarded for taking a risk on a new startup, right? If they get, you know, no one gets fired for hiring IBM, right? It's the old adage, slowly but surely changing. But back when we were starting 2014 and we were fully cloud-based on Amazon Web Services in the public cloud, that alone took a bunch of convincing for companies to put their data in cloud. We were sometimes, or a lot of the times, the first time these companies were ever putting any of their data in the cloud. And like, they're like, so internally, there's a big pitch to build credibility. You know, you need to get good investors in. Like, we had Enterprise Ireland, we were on the Wayra Accelerator. We were slowly but surely ticking them off. And then being able to articulate in those meetings our understanding of the industry, pitch a vision based on our experience of where we think things are going in the next 10 years and how we're going to enable companies to get there. That was a huge source of credibility. And I think that was one of the factors that won us our first clients. And then, like any B2B business, if you have 1, 2, 3 reference clients, you'll get to 10. If you have 10, you'll get 25. And 25, you get to 100, if you can just execute well.
Talk to me about those, after that first 6 months. You had 6 months runway. What happened then? Runway come hurtling to an end. How did you survive?
So we scrapped around. We did New Frontiers, which was the 15K. We got a Waterford Enterprise grant, which was myself and Padraig, our technical co-founder, who had built the first version of the software. So the two of us had about 6 months runway. Before that, we just scraped some money together to get Padraig working part-time. And then we did Wayra, which was a great accelerator that added a lot of credibility. And I think we were in that program when we signed our first client. We got CSF from Enterprise Ireland. So we were scraping around small bits of money to keep ourselves going and build a small team and win our first clients. And that was enough to get us up and running at the time.
So your entire focus was on what in those months? Because I think for early stage entrepreneurs, it's not the work ethic. It's not your energy. It's your focus can often be the most difficult thing to control.
It's how do we get our first customer? That was like the big focus. And then secondary to that was, how do we ensure we have enough runway to get to our first customer? And how can we be as lean as possible to give ourselves as much time? And in a way, you know, we were thinking about Task Messenger for a while before we went full time, so we could make some progress in parallel that gave us an extension at the far side. But yeah, if you can give yourself as much room to discover stuff, because oftentimes, like with Task Messenger, that was just a conversation opener to different clients to discover what the big problem was that they were going to ultimately pay us for. And that led us to starting Fundrex and building out that business. And we had scraped together enough time to make that happen. Now, if you can't get that time, you might run out of runway and have to go back and get a job, and then the dream's over and it's back to the drawing board. But yeah, we managed to balance those two things of staying focused to get the customer. And don't get me wrong, we were doing silly, unfocused things at the same time, like all this, the mistakes that you could make of, you know, going to conferences that weren't relevant, where your customers weren't at. But you kind of have to learn those the hard ways, because people can tell you all about it, but you know, sometimes you have to make the mistake yourself before you fully take the lesson on board.
The excitement overcomes you. You start living the lifestyle. Yeah. You start going to the conferences. I saw a great tweet yesterday and made me laugh. If you ship your swag before your product, it's a red flag.
I seen that one.
It's great.
Yeah. No, there's loads of stuff like that that you look back and say, oh, well, I do that differently. And I think that's possibly why, you know, people love back in second time entrepreneurs, because they know they've learned that experience and they've gone through. And we were just chatting about Adam Newman's new startup earlier, and you know, how we can see both the pros and cons and why people love and hate it and why people would back them and why people think it's madness. But there's a lot to be said for having lived through a startup, come out the other side, and then starting your second one. You're not starting from scratch anymore. You've accelerated all that learning.
The second entrepreneur thing is really interesting.
Yeah.
I think that's a great point, because you've done it all, and you hit the nail on the head there earlier. You can be told, but you can't be told.
No.
There's certain things you have to experience pain.
You can't do an online course to be an entrepreneur and come out the far side knowing what you need to do. You'll still make the same mistakes that you were going to make without that course. I think you can't underestimate experience when it comes to startups. And at the same time, like a lot of, just going back to startup advice, a lot of it's contradictory, because sometimes the naivety of not knowing what you shouldn't be doing leads you down the right path of solving the problem. So like, you know, maybe if we didn't know how hard it was going to be, we wouldn't have gotten as far as we did, because like startups are really, really hard. And what people often don't realize until they've gone through it, the emotional journey is the toughest part, like the ups and downs, the things are going wrong. And that's why, you know, having a great co-founder or a co-founder at all is usually helpful, because at the early days where it was just me, Padraig, and him and Dez was working with us, if one of us is having a bad day and, you know, you don't feel like you're going to get out of bed or you need a boost, someone else will lift you up. And once you're not overlapping the same week, both of you are having bad weeks, it's good, because, you know, there's only, the business won't make any progress if you're not like pushing forward. Mm. And as a small team, it feels so slow. Like even at those early days, trying to move things on takes so long. And you need co-founders that you can trust and are going to support you emotionally along the way.
Was that an intentional decision to have a co-founder, or was that an accidental?
Yeah, no, definitely intentional. Like we knew we'd gaps. So like myself and Dez are both technical, but not, you know, capable of building a scalable web app. Padraig gave us that expertise. I guess Dez is probably the most positive person I know by default. So that, you're going to definitely need someone like Dez in a startup, right? For the down days.
Everyone needs a Dez.
And then we balance each other out in that I'm probably more inclined to take risks. He'd be more of a conservative voice. And then between the two of us, we can kind of balance that. You know, he can pull me back from doing stupid stuff, and then I can kind of drag him into doing some of the crazier bits that we're thinking about.
You mentioned earlier about learning from your customers.
Yeah.
How did you do that without seemingly not appearing like you didn't know what you were doing? How did you go out and go, hey, you've got the new solution, blah, blah, blah. Now tell us everything you need.
Yeah, you sell them a vision. You'd say, listen, and you start off with the problem. That's the important part. It's like, we understand that your pain point is the data comes in all these formats. You need a software developer to code the integrations. Wouldn't it be great in the future if we could build a system where you can manage it yourself as a business user? And they go, yeah, great. I'd love to do that. And we go, well, okay, here's the first version we've put together.
Is that a tactic to ask a question you already know the answer is going to be yes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we had the benefit of having, you know, been in their roles and done their job. So we kind of knew the problem that we were getting into. And, you know, they were, you know, those businesses wanted to be doing more with less people, and they wanted to be serving their customers faster and serving more customers. So like that fundamental challenge that they had was well known. And it was just about tapping into that and saying, okay, well, here's how we get you from where you are now to where you want to be in the future. And we had some great early customers that were fantastic development partners. And I probably describe them as founding customers as much as early customers, because, you know, they helped provide us with the support. You know, they gave us references, you know, encouragement. And you have to remember, like, these are people that they don't get a bonus if they bring in a new startup that helps save the company a bunch of money.
I think, like, that's the thing people don't get, though.
There's no upside. So they're invested in your story.
Yeah.
Saying, you know what, I'd love to see Alan Dez be successful in the industry, needs something like this, and wouldn't it be great?
I think entrepreneurs don't really understand that though.
Yeah.
They're so full of enthusiasm and the joys. And this is such a good product.
No one cares.
That they don't realize Alan doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
Alan's thinking, okay, one more meeting now before lunch.
Yeah. No one cares about your startup. And it kind of brings us on to another fun area. And it's kind of that early stage greenness that you have. You know, oh, what if I can't tell anyone about my idea because what if they find out about they're going to copy me?
This is my pet peeve.
I would have had to convince Des at one point, Des, no one gives a shit what we're doing.
Yeah.
We're going to struggle to convince people it's important at all. And then it's going to be another, you know, merit and effort to get them to buy off us. And like, you know, until you're successful, no one's going, who wants to copy an unsuccessful startup? Like, the only people that people want to copy is someone that's had success, yeah. had the traction.
Tell me your secrets. Tell me your hacks.
You know, and then they might start, you might see copycat startups, but it's not going to be like, oh, you're before your first customer, but we're going to rip off your idea. Like ideas are in themselves worthless. It all comes down to execution. And you know, sometimes you feel like shaking an early stage entrepreneur and just trying to shout at them. You know, it doesn't matter if people find out what you're doing. You need to be telling people, but comes back to that's one of the things you just kind of have to let them learn themselves the hard way.
Stealth mode.
Yeah, I think there's
the worst words in the world.
If you search LinkedIn, there's thousands of stealth mode people working at stealth mode startups. Oh, yeah. And there's probably a handful of occasions where it would make sense where you're doing deep tech and there is IP and there is something you're doing. Maybe there's a platform change and there's something important that secret you found that you do want to keep quiet while you build it out. And it's like a 2 or 3 year build.
But a handful in a very world small of thousands.
Handful, very small handful. Like you know, being vocal as a startup, you attract investors, customers, and team members, right? If you're not like an interesting startup to work at and you don't have interesting problems to solve, you know, how are talented people going to find out about you and want to join you?
No one's listening. You're going to have to, like, we live in a noisy yeah. world. No matter what you're doing, if you're selling a product, hiring, telling a story, no one's listening the first time. It's always like 4 or 5 times. I might talk about something on the pod, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times. And then the 10th time, somebody like, did you mention something about it? And I'm like, yeah, every week.
We have the retention of a goldfish.
And it's getting worse.
Yeah, it's getting worse.
So I think for founders, that's unbelievable advice to go, keep talking.
Yeah.
Because it'll take years.
Yeah, you look at startups that have done well, they have a very clear message and they repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and keep drilling it home. And that's the key to it, like, because like you said, it's only on the 4th or 5th time you're hearing it, sometimes the things click.
And that's the bigger skill. The bigger skill is honing it down to a sentence.
Oh, it's incredibly difficult.
Because you're either in stealth mode or you give me an A4.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? I still don't understand what you do.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get added on LinkedIn and you're like, what does this person do? Their title is so ambiguous and then the company is so ambiguous. You're like, I have no idea what you do.
We still struggle with it. And, you know, if you talk to anyone in fund administration and, you know, they'll say, oh, you know, is that a wedding? And someone asked me, what do I do? And I just say, well, I work in finance.
The wedding test. I've talked about this before.
They're going to go down the rabbit hole of trying to explain a whole industry that they don't really, can't really articulate themselves.
Using the salt shakers to just props.
Here's the investor. Here's the fund. So it's, if you can get that message clear, and I think we're still not there yet with the stuff that we're doing, and we're probably in a transitionary period ourselves. But if you can get that right, that really builds a big market for you.
I think being able to tell a story in a coherent way is going to become a superpower. It's going to become, as marketers, it's going to become an absolute superpower. Cutting through the noise and having a clear, consistent, we talked about this over breakfast. So many social media outlets now, where should you be focusing? Probably most of them, but how do you get a clear, consistent message across on all of them? It's so hard. Because we talked about the difference between Twitter and LinkedIn.
Hmm.
Twitter Alan and LinkedIn Alan.
Yeah.
They're slightly different people.
Yeah.
But you still have to have the same underlying core.
Yeah, you need to be authentic in your message on both platforms and obviously aware that they're for different audiences. And like even today or this week, I've heard of tech companies are paying some content writers $700,000 a year to write content for them. That's how valuable they see it as being. Because the B2B marketing playbook hasn't really changed in the last 10 years. You've got inbound, obviously HubSpot driven a lot of that, which is your blogs, you know, your webinars, your white papers, your video interviews. But, you know, outside of those 5 or 6 things, there's nothing too new has happened really in B2B marketing, other than people have churned out tons and tons of bad content, really. You know, fluff pieces, stuff where they've read, oh, well, I need to include all these phrases for SEO, and that's where they've started with writing their content. And then you get a clickbait headline, you open up and go, you know what, like, there's actually no substance to what they've wrote here at all, other than I can see a few words in it.
And the worst of all, it's boring.
Very boring.
Boring content.
Yeah, so that's the hard part. It's kind of coming up. And we try to do with our content a little bit is to go deep on a topic. Like we've an industry that has a ton of M&A. So we were looking a few years ago to find out, well, who has bought who? And we couldn't find anything. And we created our own M&A tracker from scratch. And you know, maybe there was like 60 deals on it. We put the details on it. And now we keep it up to date and we get see about 25 deals a year on it. But probably that's probably one of our top performing web pages because
it's useful.
It's niche content. Yeah. It's really useful and people know where to find it and can't get anywhere else. And I think, and that is, you know, the essence of inbound marketing is put together a piece of content that will really add value for your customers. And then later on, they'll buy from you once you've built that relationship.
You've touched on an interesting topic there. We talked about it again over breakfast. Is marketing changing?
It is changing for sure. We're seeing more consumer stuff being done in enterprise. I think everything is going video, hence today.
Hence we're sitting here right now. Hence video. Why Ben is on my right, exactly.
Yeah. And you know, throwing money at AdWords and Facebook ads and LinkedIn ads, is it really getting the return that people were hoping for? And you know, is it going to get them to a place they want to be? Probably not, I don't think. I think people are kind of realizing that, especially in the VC land, that just giving money to Facebook and Google isn't a great strategy.
It was working, but it's not anymore. No, give us the new lowdown. What's the new path people should be walking?
I'm going to be slightly controversial and say in-person events are going to be making a big comeback. Yeah. What's old is new again. we've had great success with a conference that we run every year called Adminovate, and it's been... We run it as a not-for-profit, so we get about 350 people to it, and we held it in Trinity College in May. But just the energy and the buzz of people, and as a company being in a position to be able to connect all those people together, it's just been amazing.
You know, superpower.
Superpower. Yeah. Like, and, you know, comes back to this controversy over, you know, remote, hybrid, back in the office. We are innately social people, and you just can't replicate some of that in-person magic remotely. So, you know, we did a company on-site in May, the week of the conference. I'd say our model look a little bit like remote fully if you want, but we'll do 3 to 4 on-sites a year where people come in, and then we'll also have hubs. So we have a Waterford office and we'll have a Dublin office opening shortly where if people want, they can come in. And I think what we're starting to see is teams are starting to organize themselves saying, okay, we're going to have a collaboration day next Thursday.
Yeah.
And they're putting their own structure on it that works for them. But I think like...
That's the key, their own structure.
Yeah.
You still see companies approaching this from, I have people that work, friends of mine who work in traditional industry, and you see them trying to have this top down, okay, on certain days we do this and this and this and this. Oh, but I'm not in that day, or I'm doing this that day.
Yeah.
It has to come from the teams, right? Yeah.
You have to incentivize people to want to meet in person. So like whether that's... You know, there's a company in our industry and they're opening a new office for 500 people during the pandemic, basically. And they've said, okay, everyone in the company is going to have their own dedicated office space, but they don't have to come in. But what they've basically done is incentivize people to know that, okay, I'm going to be sitting beside Gary if I do turn up to the office and not some random person.
That's pretty
I'm
going to
have like my umbrella, my gym bag in the same place. So it makes it a lot easier to come into the office. And then, you know, stuff like, okay, we'll treat team lunches or we'll do a night out on a Thursday. I think you have to incentivize people that they want to come in. And then, like you said, empower them to decide what's the best work pattern for their team or them as individuals, because everyone's so different.
Is that what you think the future of work is? The quarterly meetups, the hubs?
I think so. I think that's what people want. Like they want to be able to spend time in person with their teammates. They want the flexibility of being able to work from home and being remote and managing their own schedules. I said to you, like, I've commuted in 4 days this week. I like, it's tough commuting. Commuting is no fun.
And it's dead
I did catch
time.
Up on a bunch of podcasts. But
that's good. Like, that's always that important. That's always important.
But it is dead time. And, you know, it's tough for people to do it 5 days a week. I think anyone that's doing it 5 days a week, it'll feel like a real drag.
Mm, it definitely will, because people have had it long enough now not to do it.
Yeah.
And when you don't do something for a good while, we're creatures of habit, just falls out of pattern. Yeah. You're like, oh, actually, the friction of going back to it is too great.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it. I don't enjoy it.
No. And, you know, there will be companies like ourselves that will be more flexible and offer to people the opportunity to continue to work like that. And, you know, now that we've gone through the fact that, well, okay, the economy is starting to turn, some of the bigger companies are getting a little bit more confident about mandating work from the office, like Apple's news this week about, okay, everyone has to come back in. They couldn't have said that 6 months ago because they would have too much attrition. They're now thinking, well,
it's a risky strategy. It's a bold move, Cotton. Like it really is. Like,
well, they're doing it. Like, they're itching to do it. They're like, okay, when do we think there's a lack of confidence in the, you know, in the hiring market that people be afraid to quit because other people are doing layoffs? I think they're trying to time it as soon as they can. But yeah, there'll be
all the middle managers who've been doing nothing for 2 years. Like, finally, I get them back under my control.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a contradiction. Like in San Francisco, it's like, okay, get back to the office. We want you to work from the office. Like, well, we can't live anywhere afford to be close to the office. So we're going to be like an hour and a half bus ride. Don't care. Like, come in, but don't build houses in our backyard, like from the senior people.
Or they don't. Freaking reason.
Yeah.
They don't live there anymore.
No.
People are living in, from an Irish perspective, Galway, Mayo, Cork, Wicklow, Waterford, just don't live in Dublin anymore.
Yeah.
It's physically not possible for them to do 5 days a week.
Yeah. And the other trend we chatted about earlier is moving to other places temporarily to work. So instead of like, I'm going to go on 2 weeks holidays, or I want to visit the US. We've got a team member come to New York in October and he's like, oh, should I just come over and work for 2 weeks? And they get to experience everything. They haven't used any holidays. So like...
And you get to live there, kind of. You get to immerse yourself into the daily routines and the habits of... You know, when you're a tourist, you kind of, it's all very surface level. It's all very kind of like, oh, you kind of dip in and dip out. You do all the nice, fun things.
Yeah.
You don't actually get to like live, you know, the whole thing. Airbnb's motto, live like a local, right?
Yeah.
But you don't actually get to do that properly. Whereas this, you do.
So you can see the Adam Newman pitch, right? Because travel is going to be back big time. It already is. Big time. Anyone's been through Dublin Airport knows that. But now, not just leisure travel, but travel to work where I can, you know, I could do, you know, beforehand, you'd have to take a sabbatical to do a around the world trip. Now you could just do it. Like you could travel the world, work in a remote job, you know, see the world, and you can still be in the same position when you come back.
A friend of mine bought a property up in very remote Donegal, and he's going to build market it as workations.
Yeah. I think it's a great idea.
He's a full office downstairs.
Yeah.
High-speed broadband, whiteboards, full office, everything someone needs. Upstairs, luxury apartment.
Yeah.
A few minutes from the beach.
Yeah, deadly.
Do very well.
And like the cost of setting that up and doing that with it in some of those remote locations instead of like a holiday let, like I think that's going to be the future of work and travel, which means for me, I'm very bullish on travel in general because you've got the old, I need to go on holidays and now you have the whole, well, I could go work anywhere. So
yeah,
I think it's going to be huge demand. Airports going to be under massive pressure.
Well, they already are, right? Mm. That kind of shows you what happens when you lay off half your workforce. But I'd like to say I'm bullish in travel as well. And in terms of like extended travel, people coming for 14 to 30 days, that kind of high-end setup whereby you come, you set up, everything's done for you. You know, people are owning less and less and less. I find it myself. I'm literally culling things every single day.
Yeah.
Like, I have no intention of going to travel the world yet, but I just find it stressful to have too much stuff and junk and just disposable things just clogging up everything.
Yeah, clutter is a bit of a pain in my life too.
So like to be able to like, but even what you do yourself, you moved to New York.
Yeah, and the fun thing about moving to New York is none departments come furnished. So you have to fill it with stuff straight away, which is an intense 2 weeks of like IKEA building, which is never fun. Top tip is to get yourself a power drill to screw stuff in, because if you have the manual one, you'll die dead.
The Allen key.
You'll have cramp after 5 minutes. But yeah, moving to new city was great fun. Like we seen it as a business opportunity and then also as like a life opportunity. Like how often are you in a position where you get to go move to the US and experience everything over there, learn about the culture and kind of immerse yourself in it. And two young kids that we brought along as well, my wife. So they've had a great experience.
But what a life experience for them.
Oh, it's been...
We moved to New York. Yeah, when I was like six, we moved to New York. Yeah. We lived there for 3-4 years.
That's super for them. Like I slag them and say, oh, listen, if you ever want to come back to go to college and play soccer in the US, I'm like, oh, I don't want to come back to the US. It's like, you'll change. Time you're a teenager, you'll definitely want to come back.
Yeah, it'd be the most magical time of their lives. They'll look back and go, oh my God, I can't believe you live in Manhattan.
Yeah.
So what spurred the move for you?
So for us, it's financial services. A lot of our customers are in the US. And as a small startup, I think we were 13 people when we moved across to the US. It's okay, well, how do we enter the US market? And it's obviously a common theme or challenge that Irish startups have to think about. And we spoke to a bunch of different people and companies that had done it. We spoke to EI customers or companies as well. And the general consensus was, when it hadn't gone well, what had happened was a salesperson had been hired, usually on, you know, a couple hundred K a year. They'd given that 6 months, still hadn't seen traction, 9 months, and then, you know, had to cut their losses after that point, and that's kind of set them back a period. So we looked at it and said, okay, what way could we do it that might be a bit scrappier, might be, you know, a bit more affordable, and then a bit of a higher chance of success. And really that was taking the personal risk of moving over ourselves and having a founder on the ground. And then, you know, from a investment perspective, we could do that much more affordably than hiring a person over there or building a small team remotely. And then I think, you know, getting yourself immersed in the culture and, you know, learning how business works in the US, you know, picking up the little nuances as well, was really beneficial to us. Like, I think it made a huge difference.
It's a ballsy move.
It's a bit like starting the company. It's another one where beforehand...
It's an inflection point.
It's an inflection point, right? And beforehand, and it's the same cycle, very stressful process going through it all, getting the family on board, telling the grandparents you're bringing the grandchildren away to the US is probably the biggest challenge.
And forever?
Forever, yeah. But you'll never come back. Oh, no, we're only going to do 2 years. And now we're coming on, we start in year four now when we go back in September. But yeah, it's not that big of a risk when you just lay it all out in front of you. Like, because you can always come back at any time. Now, we did get stuck there with the pandemic a little bit. And that was another unique experience. But for us, it just made sense, right? It was the least risky thing that sounded risky externally, right? For internally, when you look at it, having a founder there driving the sales themselves, because I still have to be paid. So if I'm in Dublin or New York, I still need to get, so that salary is transferable. And then you only need a couple of customers and your investment pays off. So for us, it was a no-brainer. And then it was just a case of, well, which founder's going to go? And probably with my kids, the age you are, it made most sense for me. So
was it something you wanted to do?
It wasn't like a long-held ambition. It was like, okay, this makes sense. And this could be, you know, really positive for the business. And this could level us up to the next level. And it has, and we've scaled through the pandemic really well. So it's paid off. And like, I've loved it over there. Like, really enjoyed it. New York's been great.
You laid this out for me earlier in beautiful terms, in terms of the actual finances.
Yeah.
Can you just give me this quick snapshot in terms of, you were going to have to hire a salesperson.
Yeah.
How much is that going to cost versus actually shipping everything and bringing you over there?
Yeah. So like a graduate, if you get a graduate that's coming out of college in the US, you're going to have to pay them, in New York specifically, you're going to have to pay them like $125 plus per year. Oof. Dollars, right? And you know, the way the exchange rate's gone now, we're nearly at parity. Mm. So that's, you know, 120, 115,000 euros. So probably health insurance on top of that as well, and other benefits. So that's an expense, and then the office space or whatever remote setup you have.
And that's just a graduate?
That's just a graduate. If you're into a junior to mid-level salesperson, it's 200K.
Wow.
If you're into like a mid-level salesperson in the US doing B2B software sales, 300 to 400K wouldn't be unusual with an OT on top of that.
I'm thinking about a lifestyle change.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to get paid big bucks, the US is the place to go. Now, so yeah, we looked at it and said, okay, well, I can move across. We can cover my apartment rent, health insurance, cost of living, all the extras for less than 150K. So like on a investment perspective, the numbers just made sense for me to go.
So it's almost on a parity bringing over a co-founder with deep industry experience,
yeah,
as it was just hiring a brand new graduate.
Yeah. And remember, like, we're selling to B2B. So when we're talking to companies and we're trying to convince them to buy from us, it's often at the early stage, and it still was then, less so now, but founder-led sales, where I'm going in, looking someone in the eye and say, listen, you can trust me. this is, you know, an example of our expertise. Here's our customer references. Here's our vision for the company. That's very difficult to do from across the Atlantic. And it's very difficult to do if you're only coming back and forth every so often. Because people see kind of, well, they're only dipping their toes in. Are they going to be committed to the US this time next year? So first it worked really well. And then one of the unintended benefits is you get a bunch of credibility here for having moved to the US with Irish customers and clients.
The famous New York office. Couldn't add it to the LinkedIn quick enough.
Yeah, we've been very lucky. We're using Bank of Ireland's hub. We've used it since we moved across.
What's that?
So if you're a Bank of Ireland business customer, there is a co-working space, pretty much like they have down in Grand Canal, where you can sign up and then turn up and use the office space.
So and have that in New York?
Have that in New York,
Unbelievable,
yeah.
I never knew that.
200 yards from my apartment. So incredible. My commute is like 200 yards in US terms, which is great. But yeah, and Tony and Kat that run that are very supportive and they've been a great help.
Class. What a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
What's it like working in New York? Because obviously we all have this image of New York, you know, this hustle bustle 24/7 lifestyle. What's it like actually living and working there?
It's a bit addictive in that there's like a ton of energy, so that you feed off the energy. There's always something to do. Part of like us being in the city was saying when we were going to move across, should we be in the suburbs that we'd have, you know, a bit of room for the kids and maybe the community, or should we be in the city? And it just came down to, well, we'll do the first year in the city because I'd be at events during the week, going to be like happy hours and drinks, could be three or four of them. And just trying to keep some work-life balance, at least if I'm in the city, I can come home for lunch or I can walk home versus catch the last train. So, you know, we kind of jumped in the deep end on that side of it and it's worked out well. And I'd probably recommend if you're going to go do it that way rather than trying to save money, because realistically, like we're committed to a year's lease anyway. So if wife and kids aren't happy after 3 months, we're kind of at a loss, right? So we had to find a way to increase the odds of everyone being happy. Even outside of your own startup industry, like you have media and you have sports and you've got everyone else are all, you know, aspiring to, you know, level up and be better. And it just raises the bar. And it's you know, that old adage, like if you're the average of the people that you surround yourself with. And if you're surrounded by people that are ambitious and successful, it's contagious. And if you're already that way minded, it just means competitively, you know, you need to up your game.
When you went over there, did you notice like this change? Was there like a noticeable kind of like in you? Was there a noticeable kind of like, oh, okay, this is big boy stuff now?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I think it helps build your confidence because it's another level ticked off when you go through, well, how are we going to scale up the business and how are we going to grow? And then I, like even at a family level, like the kids went to school and started school in the US, gone to public school. Non-denominational, the only two Irish kids, multicultural, all sorts of social classes.
Class.
So a real
brilliant
drop into deep end for them, right? And they've so flexible, they've been brilliant. But like, even after 2 months, the increase in their confidence, it was blowing me away. It's like, Jesus, where did they get this confidence from? Because in their classes, like their teacher will ask them, so Aaron, how do you feel about it? Or, you know, what's your opinion on things? Like, I don't remember ever getting asked in the Irish education system.
No, definitely not.
What my opinion was on anything or how I felt about it. So you can then, you get a better understanding, okay, well, if kids are coming up through that system, now I know why all the salespeople sound so amazing coming out of college. Because they'll stand up and present even at that young age in front of the class. And yeah, it's a different world and a different level of ambition. And, you know, when they say, what's the difference culturally between doing business and doing in Europe and the US? The obvious one, it's probably well known at this stage, is you get a quick no in the US. So, you know, we'll go in to pitch someone, you know, try and help understand their problem. This is our solution. They'll tell me quite quickly whether they think it's a runner or not. But then when they say no, you'll get two or three referrals from them and say, you know what, you should go talk to Mike. Or, you know, I've heard they're looking to automate stuff, and you'll get a referral from them. And that's great, right? That's what you want as an entrepreneur or as a salesperson. You want to say, okay, quickly qualified where it's an opportunity. If it's not an opportunity, how do I discover more? In Ireland and Europe, like even other startups that we know, where like with a large Irish bank, they've been pitching to talking to someone in their senior level for 7 meetings, right? And they're cloud-based, same as us, Amazon Web Services. And I'd asked them earlier on, can you use cloud? And yeah, totally, yeah, no problem. And then we went to a procurement event that they were at as well. And the procurement person in that company said, no, we're local only. So she had to go back to her contact at the bank and say, can you just do me a favor and just go and double check whether you can use cloud? And reluctantly he did and came back and said, no, we can't. And they were already scheduling meeting number 8 when they could never buy, like.
And you're talking months
of wasted time, right?
There.
And, you know, that could have been spent, you know, pursuing valid opportunities. So
that's super advice. An entrepreneur only gave that about a couple of months ago, and people keep talking about it from her episode, Rena Maycock. She talked about the slow no. Mm. Don't get a slow no.
Slow no is a killer. And in Ireland, we are our own worst enemies because...
Oh, just can't get to the point.
Well, both as a buyer, but also as a seller, we'll often not want to get to the bad news. Yeah. So we'll avoid the hard questions and we won't ask the hard qualifying questions. So we won't, quickly establish whether there is a qualified lead or not. So
is that a scarcity mindset from being in a small market?
I think so. Yeah, that would make sense to me because, you know, you don't want to, you know, reduce your pipeline by getting rid of the non-qualified leads. You want to, you know, think there is something there. But you know, until you learn that lesson the hard way, which we would have done as well, like we would have been guilty of ourselves of not getting to the nose or not asking hard questions. And then as you get a bit experienced and say, well, why am I wasting my time? Or as you see a contrast with doing business in the US, you say like, this is the way to go.
Has that shaped you, how you approach things now? Has that changed how you approach things?
Yeah, no, definitely. Like on the sales side, it's changed. Ambition wise, it's changed things. And even culturally, just being, you know, closely interacting with US companies and seeing that, you know what, we're better than these as companies. Like our people are more talented. The ideas we have are better. And then it just, I guess, there's no fear factor of competing with them. You're now, you know, emboldened and say, well, okay, well, we're just as good, if not better than these. Why can't we be more successful? I think that's something that Irish people can often fall victim to as well, is kind of underestimating how good they are. Because we have some amazing startups in Ireland, like, and you know, we've seen the reward for it in the last few years where we've gotten, I think, 4 or 5 unicorns.
It really has picked up pace,
and you know, the ambition has gotten bigger. And even going back to our early days, so we've had an office space in Cluster in Dublin, which Goodwin Lawler runs, and the room that we were in, which is holds probably 8 people, the company before us was Brightflag, and the company before them was Flipdish.
Oh wow.
So that room has generated about 800 Irish jobs.
That's
from that one room in the last, you know, 8 or 9 years. So like we're seeing companies now hit those scale up points that we just didn't years ago. Like those 2 companies might have sold well before where they've gotten to now.
Yeah.
But now they have the ambition and people have led the way. And oftentimes it's just, you know, it's a bit like the 4-minute mile. Once someone does it once, clicks with people.
My theory is you have to see it.
You have to
be able to see it. If you can't see it, you don't believe it.
Yeah.
It's very, very common. The people I've sitting in front of me here, they'll have seen like a dad or a mom or an uncle or an auntie or a friend or a cousin be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And suddenly they're like, oh, that's fine. It's just like my job. It's just different. And like, I think you touched on it exactly there. The Irish ecosystem is now at a stage. But definitely when you started, it was so raw.
Yeah.
There was very few, none companies you'd point
out. Intercom were the pioneers early.
Yeah. And even back then, though, they would have been early.
And they were a US company, pretty much, you know.
So like to have truly Irish companies come through, go, yeah, they've reached unicorn status by being based down in the Keys or in Grand Canal or wherever. So that's a mindset thing, do you think?
I think it's a mindset. And it's also... the tech industry and the startup industry as a whole has just grown. SaaS has become way, way bigger than people thought it would be 10 years ago. And we've seen that up until recently in the public markets where SaaS businesses that, you know, when investors invested them, they would have been happy to get the 5 or 10 billion as a market cap. Are now we're seeing those companies grow to 50, 60, 70 billion in market cap, which is partly what driven the valuations madness that we've seen last year, is because I guess the upside of the outcomes when it goes well is so much bigger. People could afford to invest at higher valuations, or at least thought they could, without the fundamentals that were there. And it made sense probably from a model perspective, but then it drove a lot of the crazy valuations and a bit of the bubble bursting that we've seen.
So you're in the B2B space.
Yeah.
How are you changing your approach? We talked this earlier about marketing's possibly changing.
Yeah.
How are you adapting to that?
So we're looking to move more towards product-led growth, which is an extremely tricky transition.
What does that mean, product-led growth?
So where we now rely on salespeople our sales development representatives to qualify leads and bring leads to the sales team, and then the sales team to move them through the pipeline, which traditionally for us is like 3 to 6 months. We find a qualified lead where they're looking for one of our solutions. We set them up with an initial call to get their requirements. Then we might move to a demo. Then from a demo, we might move to a POC. And then from POC to a full contract.
That sounds long.
That's long, right? And involved and requires top-down sponsorship. So you need, you know, sign off from a senior person to go ahead with all this. And now we're looking at more of a bottom-ups approach or you know, a product-led growth approach where a bit like a Zapier or a Slack or really any of those businesses that are getting in end users first and then are getting enterprise adoption later.
You know, okay, so you're flipping the model. Used to be top to top,
yeah,
and now it's going to be bottom to top.
Yeah, and it's kind of, I think, the new blend that we're going to see a lot of B2B companies have to adapt because just the economics of getting those marketing qualified leads through the sales funnel first and the fact that, you know, everything has gone so remote and different from a buying perspective, I think we're going to have to change in that direction because end users just want their problem solved. Senior people want all the enterprise box ticked. There is a middle ground in between the two of them where you can appeal to both worlds. You know, we've seen it in, you know, with some of our competitors where they've struggled to get into large banks because there's a legacy system that, you know, is too big of a project to replace. But if we can get their end users to start replacing those workflows with our solutions initially, that just changes the game because then it's just a case of, well, I want single sign-on, MFA, all the good enterprise stuff that I need. And the end users themselves are driving the transformation.
Okay, so it's almost like a guerrilla tactic of getting in on the ground and then building a groundswell of support and then people kind of requesting it up the chain.
Yes, very hard to do because you need to get the people to the top of the marketing funnel initially. So you have to figure that piece out. Where are these people? How do I get to them? How do we get our message across? How do we get them to understand the problem or that we have a solution for their problem? Then how do I convert that to a trial or, you know, a free user? How do I onboard them to the product and get them to the eureka moment within the first 120 seconds where they've created some sort of value for themselves?
That's tight.
Because onboarding to a software product is tough, right? And as we discussed, people are becoming more and more impatient. So if they're not seeing something happening in the first few minutes of signing up for free trial, that will likely get abandoned and they won't return to it, right? So we need them to solve a problem in the first, you know, couple of minutes, whether that's create the first workflow or do something of value to them, that eureka moment. And then from there, it's kind of managing through the product funnel and getting them to create more workflows, getting them to a point where they'll invite their coworkers. And the great thing about product-led growth, if you can get it working well, it forces your product to be really good because you can't be successful if it's not easy to use. So like where some enterprise products now will ultimately run out of steam is after a few years, they've kind of added feature after feature after feature, becomes more and more and more complicated to use. And then something newer, more simple comes along and gradually replaces them. But with product-led growth, you can't lose that simplicity because you won't get new users. So it is, I think, a great model if we can get to work. Other companies have done it successfully before. Some of them have been straight away, we're going to be product-led growth companies. Others have transitioned from being top-down to product-led. We're trying to do that transition at the moment. And it's a lot of fun. So like, you know, the thing about startups is once you're trying new things and I guess learning as a founder, there's no end of runway for you. Like I keep going once I'm doing new things.
I have one final question for you.
Sure.
What book would you recommend? Is there been a book over your career? It can be business, personal, anything, just had an impact on you? Kind of helped you along or you just found it entertaining?
So there's a great startup book that's not anything to do with startups.
Perfect.
It's called Touching the Void by Joe Simpson.
Ah, yes.
Have you read it, Gary?
I haven't, but it's been recommended before a few times.
And it has, I think, been turned into a movie. But I read it before I left full-time work, I read it. And just found so many overlapping themes with entrepreneurship in it. So the rough story is two guys go mountain climbing in the Andes, get successfully to the summit on a site that's never been climbed before, have a series of accidents on the way down, and a couple of decisions, life and death decisions to make, that they had to make, and managed to kind of successfully extradite themselves from the situation. But it is just a series
Spoiler alert.
Well, who'd write the book if they didn't? So it's a series of like highs and lows, and then also, I guess, you know, when you think about it, in startups, we're often making what we think are life and death decisions, yeah. right? It's not life and death, it's a business, right? It's not going, people might lose their jobs and get hired somewhere else, is the worst case scenario. But there was just so many overlaps between the two of them. And I think the emotional journey is probably what I associate with most. It's like, okay, they've had to grind it out, find solutions where there's no solution. You know, they've had to, you know, overcome massive obstacles and, you know, jump in with 2 feet in certain instances to what they thought was the best path forward, even though there was massive uncertainty and probably a high likelihood of it not working. So I just thought that book was a great thing for people to read that writer in entrepreneurship or thinking about it, just to kind of get a, because like we said earlier, it's hard to understand how emotionally taxing a startup is until you do it. And that's probably the closest I've seen. Because I remember like reading that book and my palms sweating.
Touching the Void.
Touching the Void by Joe Simpson.
Perfect. Alan, where can people learn more about yourself and Fundrex?
Sure. www.fundrex.com. And then Alan Meany on Twitter and LinkedIn. And yeah, follow us there and you'll find out more.
Alan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a million, Gary.